Hello and welcome back to the God Story Podcast. I'm Brent Siddle and I'm back in Palmerston North, New Zealand with Rito, the Reverend Ian Reid of King's Grace Presbyterian Church. Rito, hi.
Hi, how are you, Brent?
I'm good. We've both been on holiday. You've been away.
I have been away, but back at it.
Yes, back at it, yes. And this is our very last... This is our second to last installment of Mark.
Penultimate.
The penultimate episode, yes. Now, where are we up to in the story? Because it's been months and months since you and I saw one another.
Yeah, so we are up to the passion narrative, kind of the point where up to Jesus' death is his crucifixion. So we've been slowly building towards that, though, haven't we? Jesus has had his last meal, and then he went to the Garden of Gethsemane where he's arrested. We talked about him being kind of tried before the Sanhedrin and before Herod and Pilate. And so we're up into the last, very last moments of Jesus' life.
Yeah. Now, how in this passage are we stepping into one of the key moments in God's eternal story? Oh, we should add, because I've just got my pages all mixed up. You can tell I've been on holiday, can't you? I should have said, folks, that today we're looking at chapter 15, from verse 16 to verse 41. Yes. Now, how in this passage are we stepping into one of the key moments in God's eternal story?
Well, this is what the podcast is called, isn't it?
God's story.
God's story.
Yes,
right?
Indeed.
Yeah, and this is the moment from the beginning, before creation, we would say that the whole universe has been driving towards this point, that God is telling his story, revealing who he is. And this is the moment where you see who the I am is, that moment back on the mountain with Moses, where God revealed himself to Moses as Yahweh. We're seeing what that actually looks like as God has created the world, steps into it. Who is this God?
Yeah. And so we're looking at chapter 15, verse 16 to 39. So let's look at verses. Rito knows where he's going. That's good. Verses 16 to 20 of chapter 15. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole battalion, and they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed, and spitting on him, and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak, and put his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. Yes, it's terrifying and such a tragic scene. Poignant, so poignant.
Yeah.
What's the significance of the way the soldiers dress Jesus here, do you think?
The whole of chapter 15 is steeped in irony. And so you have him being dressed as a king. So he's got a crown on, but what is it? It's a crown of thorns. He's got a robe on, and it's a purple robe signifying his royalty. So you've got this whole kind of thing where he's being dressed as a king, as it's kind of a play,
They're mocking him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're a king. You're not. We'll dress you as a king and make fun of you. Yes.
But it's kind of the irony of the whole universe being played out here as well. Because I might be wrong. How did they make the purple robes?
Well, they would have used purple dye, which was very costly.
But how did that? Yeah, the purple dye, was it from squid ink or something? Was it something like that? Like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, something.
I can't remember.
It was very expensive.
Yeah.
I don't know where they got it from. But
yeah, it was very difficult to make, clothing was difficult to make.
Yeah.
But so you've got this, this whole royal kind of setting being placed before us.
Yes. Now, is there any biblical theological significance to the crown of thorns, do you think?
I don't know. Is there?
Well, I think it was Alistair Roberts I was talking to, and he made the point, or I read in one of Alistair's articles, that the thorns and thistles, it's a reference back to the fall and the garden.
That's interesting.
And
isn't
Genesis
it? Yeah.
3. And so Jesus is literally, again, they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But he is wearing on his head, on his very person, a symbol of the sin and the fall that he's come to defeat through his death, which is an extraordinary. No, I tell you who, it was Ian Valancourt. It was Ian Valancourt who mentioned that, one of the podcasts. I thought that was fabulous.
But so rather than it being a sign of toiling, it's on his head as a place of victory,
be read that way too, symbolising the pain and the suffering and the sin of the fall.
Yep.
But also it is a sign of victory. He's wearing it as a crown. In other words, he's going to be victorious over it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes. Okay, so what sort of coronation is this?
I think this is the most interesting part of these narratives, particularly in Mark and John, is similar, that it is a coronation, that he is becoming the king, and they're doing it in a way thinking, you know, we're mocking him, we're going to destroy him. But actually this is God's moment where he becomes the ruler. He already was the ruler of the whole universe, but he becomes the supreme ruler because he's able to undo sin, reveal himself in all his grace and mercy as well.
Yes. In what sense do you think the soldiers are mocking God?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going on here. They're playing out what all humanity does in that mocking. They're saying to God, as we all do, you know, we have come to destroy you. You are so little, you are nothing. We're here to destroy you. But God turns that on its head. And
so they become representatives of humanity.
Yeah.
Just as Jesus also is representative of humanity at the same time.
Yeah.
And they play out the whole gospel story, the whole story of the Bible, without knowing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there is no sense that they know what's going on, right? They're just doing what every human being does.
Yes, pure hate.
Yeah, in destroying the God that's before us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so profound. Verses 21 to 32 of chapter 15. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, or Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, carrying lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers. I always find this significant, whether it is or not, I don't know. They crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. So many details here, Rito.
Yes, lots.
So full of meaning. What is Golgotha?
So it's a place outside of the city. It's basically it's known as the place of the skull, isn't it?
Mm.
But it's the refuse kind of area, isn't it? The kind of let's chuck all our waste out there from the city. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not a particularly desirable area.
No. And what's the significance of or is there any significance, do you think, to the wine mixed with myrrh? Because Jesus rejects the first lot of wine, doesn't he?
I don't know. Is there an Old Testament reference?
I don't know, but I think it could be. The priests in the temple, while they were doing the sacrifices, they couldn't drink. They couldn't drink wine, and I'm wondering whether that's a reference back. So Jesus is saying, like, I'm the true high priest,
and not I can't drink it at this point because I am performing the sacrifice.
That's right, and he's about to offer the ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah,
that could be what the significance of it is, and why he rejects it. The third hour. Now the time. The third hour of what? Is there any significance to the fact that this happens at the third hour? I take it this is about what?
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock in the morning. The Rome. Now this is interesting because Mark's running on Roman time, so the Roman day started about 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
So the third hour was about 9.
Mm.
The sixth hour was noon.
Yep.
And the ninth hour was about 3 p.m.
Yep.
Whereas the other gospels seem to run on Jewish time. They run from the Jewish hour a day, which was from sunset to sunset.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
But is there any significance in the third, do you think?
Well, the number three is always significant in the Bible.
Yeah.
But thinking of the third day as resurrection.
Yeah.
The third day, the third week, the third hour. It's always a time of new beginnings.
Yeah.
I suspect that's the theme that's running through there.
Mm.
Could be wrong. I don't know. I've always been fascinated by the fact that the two robbers are placed on either side of him. Do you have any thoughts about that? Have you ever wondered about that?
Not particularly, but isn't there, you know, kind of... what does Isaiah have to say about, you know, kind of that, you know, kind of his discarded, you know, kind of, you know, in the suffering servant kind of songs, that he's kind of he's off with the, you know, the mockers.
And yeah, the mockers. And, yeah,
you know, kind of, and the sinners and things like that. It's interesting, isn't it, that that Mark doesn't record what it does in the other Gospels with the conversation between the robbers and Jesus. It just says that they were kind of there, and that's about it.
Mm. Yeah, I always have a picture. I go back to the tabernacle and temple and think of the throne of God. And if this is Jesus crowned and enthroned, what is on either side of the throne of God in the tabernacle?
And it's interesting.
Two cherubim.
Yeah.
And is it significant that there are two figures placed on either side of the enthroned Christ? I don't know.
But it's also interesting that you have, I was reading this the other day, that the sons of Zebedee's mother, which is James and John, come and ask Jesus, can one of my sons be on your left and one on your right?
Oh, for sure, yes.
And he says, can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink from? They said, yes, we can. And he said, yes, you will, but it's not for me to determine.
Yeah.
You know, the idea being that I'm going to my crucifixion, to my death.
Yeah.
Would you be prepared to be on my left and my
right?
Yes. You
know, I hadn't thought of that.
In that. At that moment, they have no idea what's going on. And they've run away, you know, kind of in this moment. But they later on will be crucified in the same way.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Okay, so in what sense then is the crucifixion the crowning moment of human history?
It kind of seems silly, isn't it? This execution is God's moment of glory, God on display, basically. Because what we're seeing here is the culmination of sin, but also the culmination of God's glory and how God is able to reveal what sin does, which is destruction, but he uses that power against it. But at the very same time, he reveals who he is, merciful and gracious, you know, which we see all through the Old Testament, but we just see it at its fulfillment at this point. Mm.
Okay, 33 to 34, I think, is next of 15. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Yeah. Okay, we've got more time references.
Yep.
What's the significance of the sixth hour and the ninth hour? And we've already discussed this, really, and indeed the three-hour period mentioned. We've got three groups of threes.
And time in Mark is really important, as we've seen along the way, that, you know, right at the beginning, time was going so fast and now it's starting to slow down.
We're going to 3 hour periods.
As we get to the end.
Three, six, and nine.
Yeah, but you do have, this seems to be an undoing of creation going on, particularly, that's what we saw with the plagues in Egypt, the darkness, the you do have this undoing of creation as darkness kind of falls and you've got kind of the earthquakes and stuff like that kind of happening. But as this undoing happens, kind of what is going on the cross is the bigger kind of thing that we need to be looking at.
Oh, so it's like an uncreation week.
I think it is, because as God is, you know, kind of on the cross dying, you kind of have an undoing of what happens in creation. So the light, it disappears and, you know, kind of the earth starts to deform itself in some ways.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Brilliant. Yeah. And also we remember going back to Exodus and the Exodus plagues, before the death of the firstborn, there was that period of darkness, which was three days.
Days, yeah.
It was 3 days.
Yeah.
So there's the connection with the 3 hours, possibly.
Yeah.
It was 3 days. And, of course, it connects Israel now with Egypt and with judgment. There's going to be another death of the true firstborn who dies for people.
Yep.
This is the true Lamb of God, the true Passover Lamb, killed around 3 p.m. So he's killed about the time that the people would in Passover would normally slaughter their Passover Lamb for the evening celebration. So Jesus, the true Passover Lamb, bringing in new Exodus, a new trimester, bringing in a new creation. Yeah, it all fits, doesn't it?
Yep.
It's awesome. Why is the dark? Well, we talked about the darkness already, but why is the darkness significant here? Are there a couple of? There's one particular Old Testament reference I noted down.
Yep.
Which is Zephaniah 1:15, which talks about the darkness of the day of the Lord.
But isn't that? It's interesting, isn't it? That when we hear about the day of the Lord, you know, kind of coming, we think of God coming in His fury to destroy creation, and we're getting ripples of that, but the destruction is of the creator of the creation, you know, kind of the one at the very center of the creation, who's not created, obviously, but Jesus, you know,
has second God's person
fury,
of the Trinity.
God's fury comes down on him.
The Son, yeah, the second person.
You know, the earth can't just but help kind of stop doing what it's, you know, yeah. what it's doing.
Yeah. Why does Jesus quote Psalm 22 here, do you think?
I have a theory.
You love Psalm 22.
Yeah, that Jesus is not necessarily saying, "Oh my God, why have you forsaken me?" As in, I'm God has abandoned me. But and Jesus does this on a number of occasions. He'll quote from the Psalms or from Old Testament passages, and when you read them, you go, "Oh wow, that offers so much more insight into it." And when you read Psalm 22, it's prophetic about what's going on. You know, it talks about the gambling for his clothes, the mocking him, and all that type of stuff is riddled all the way through it. And by the end of the psalm, even though David says, "My God," it starts with, my God, why have you forsaken me?" He doesn't end that way. He says, "Oh no, God, you were never away from me. You are always here with me."
Okay,
so I think it's not a reference to the kind of that he feels forsaken, but it's a reference. Go and read the psalm.
Yeah, go and read
and
the psalm.
And see the victory in the psalm through the suffering.
Yes, wonderful. Ah, so much. 35 to 36. Ah. And some of the bystanders hearing it said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." Why do people respond the way they do here, do you think?
Well, the Elijah reference is a reference to Malachi, where Jesus says, where the writer of Malachi, which is Malachi, says, "Before the great and awful day comes," he's talking about judgment coming, "I will send Elijah." And, you know, they've missed out on John the Baptist, clearly, and Jesus says, you know, Elijah has come because of that. And so they're expecting Elijah, the prophet, to come before, you know, the judgment comes or whatever is going on. And there was also a theory, I think, that Elijah helped those who were dying or, you know, kind of to take the spirits. Or so it's kind of in that kind of vein, I think.
Okay, this is the second time Jesus has offered wine. Now, why is it sour wine? And I've written down, it should be Psalm 69, verses 19 to 21, where he says, "I've been offered wine mixed with gall." So it's a fulfillment of that psalm.
And you do have other psalms talking about, you know, kind of drinking the cup, drinking it down to its dregs, you know, kind of that. But the idea is not, it's not a sweet wine either, you know, kind of it's bitter.
Yeah. Okay, 37 to 39 to finish, chapter 15. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. That's the end of it. That's the end of the temple system, isn't it? And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Of a very slightly dodgy John Wayne story.
Okay.
About that. John Wayne was once cast as the centurion in a film about Jesus, the life of Jesus. And he said, you know, this verse, "Truly, this was the Son of God." And the director said, "Cut. More awe, John. I want more awe." So John Wayne said, "Oh, truly, this was the Son of God." I'll probably cut that out, actually. It's not really appropriate. Why is the temple curtain torn in two here?
It's symbolic of kind of in Exodus you have this, not the dimensions for the temple, but the dimensions for the curtain, for the tabernacle, which is the kind of a big tent area where the priest could go and serve. And in the most holy place, the Holy of Holies, you have this huge curtain, which is basically like a massive carpet, huge carpet. But woven into the carpet, I think this is one of the most interesting things, figures of what? Cherubim, angels.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Kind of figures in this carpet. And it's this beautiful kind of a thing that's there. But I think it's symbolic of the Garden of Eden, where when Adam and Eve are kicked out, what happens? There are cherubim there or angels there guarding the way. Mm. So it's a guarding of God's presence. That if you come in here, what's going to happen? You know, it's a warning sign. Do not enter.
Yeah.
If you enter, you are entering into God's presence. And so you have it, I think in the Garden of Eden, you have it in the temple and the tabernacle. You also have it with when they enter God's promised land, when Joshua goes in, who's the first thing he meets? He meets an angel with a sword.
Yes, the angel of the Lord, yes.
Protecting the land, right? Mm. And so, but what's happened here, that's been split in two. That's been torn open.
Mm.
And so free access into God's presence is now possible.
And now possible for the whole world, as the centurion's response shows us. He is a Gentile. This has got to be massively significant.
And there is some, you know, kind of discussion around, you know, surely in the Greek, it could be read, surely this was the son of a god, right? And it could be read that way. But that's not Mark's point. That phrase, the son of God, has been littered the whole way, you know, purposely put at certain points for us to go, oh, okay, this is what's going on. It's a centurion saying this. You've got it right in the very first verse. You've got God saying it in chapter one. You've got Peter saying it. You've got the demon saying it. It's in chapter one and two, I think. You've got Peter saying it in chapter eight. And now, what have you got? You know, you are the Christ, the Son of God, and here you've got a centurion saying it.
Mm, massively significant, given the fact that Jesus' ministry has been to Israel and he's been rejected.
Yeah.
And now here is a Gentile person.
It's open to everyone, right?
Yeah, and a centurion. And they've just been, the Roman army have just been mocking Jesus. And now we have this Roman centurion, presumably he's Roman, who is accepting who Jesus was,
but not also and also this, you know, Rome is they're the oppressor.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
kind of, they're the ones who've come in with their big empire to kind of come and destroy. And Jesus, this person is now accepted into this new kingdom.
Yes,
where you know everyone is expecting Jesus to come and undo their empire, but just say no, I'm coming to establish a new kingdom where everyone is accepted, no matter what race or yeah, kind of background you're from.
Wonderful. Rito, the Reverend Ian Reid of King's Grace Presbyterian Church, Palmerston North, New Zealand, thank you so much for your time. Next time, we're on to the very last episode in our study of Mark. And thanks to our creative team at Liquid Edge, who sponsor this podcast and who take care of things behind the scenes. Ian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode of the God Story Podcast. If you want to help us make more great episodes like this one, you can head over to our Patreon page and become a God Story Podcast supporter. You'll receive our undying gratitude, plus a few bonus goodies for your ongoing support. Just visit patreon.com/godstorypodcast. That's patreon.com/godstorypodcast. As always, you can get in touch with us via our website, godstorypodcast.com.